We have four esteemed people to talk today, and then we'll do Q&A, and we'll do the normal thing. I want to encourage people to come up and ask questions, because obviously that's, for us, the best part of the discussion. I'm going to do a brief introduction, and then I'll get right to it. I think everybody in this room knows that I'm a believer in cellulosic biofuel. There's a lot of framing by our adversaries suggesting that we're not going fast enough and we're not successful enough. But when I look out and I see the schedule, a December 2007 signing, a 2010, the rules done 5 years later, we're doing what we're doing today, it's pretty incredible. I said it on the panel before this, and I really believe that this is an amazing time for our industry. And not surprisingly, it is also a crossroads for our program, the RFS, and for our industry. And I say not surprisingly because this is the part where it gets hard. This is the part where we diversify feedstock, introduce new technologies, and agencies like EPA have to look down and decide whether we're going to change the fuel markets at a fundamental level or we're just going to change them to the point where the oil industry is comfortable. And I look forward to that challenge as an advocate for the industry. And our first panelist is Bill Feary. He is the president of DuPont Biosciences, Industrial Biosciences. I noticed when I was looking at Bill's bio that he became the president in November 2013, which would be the exact moment that the Obama administration proposed to change the RFS. So he's now experienced in the art of trying to get a program back on track, and I look forward to his presentation. Thanks, Bill.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, Brooke. My name is William Feary. I'm the president of DuPont's Industrial Biosciences business. Thank you for the opportunity to talk today about the business of cellulosic ethanol. As Brooke said, I'm relatively new to this conference and to the industry, so I thought what I'd do is I'd take a couple of minutes to talk a little bit about how it seems from my perspective and a few of my thoughts on this. So it's my pleasure to be here today to talk about what lies ahead for an industry that many said would never come to fruition in the first place. But it's here, and not only is it here, but together our industry is delivering on our national vision of a cleaner, more sustainable transportation fuel, a reduction in dependency on imported fossil fuels, and an invigoration of rural economies with jobs for American workers. It's a victory of science, industry, policy, and plain, good old-fashioned hard work, and it's an accomplishment that we all share in together. But to address the title of the conference right now, the session right now, to address the question of what lies ahead, we have to first look back. So let's look back and take stock in how far we've come. Look back and take a lesson from the growth and maturation of first-generation biofuels and what that might mean for what lies ahead for us in advanced biofuels. So today I'd like to review with you some of the lessons learned from our journey in grain ethanol, and then I'd like to spend a little time giving you an update on our progress to date with our cellulosic ethanol business in Nevada, Iowa, and then finally spend some time talking about DuPont's view of how we see cellulosic ethanol evolving here at home and around the world. So with that, let's begin. I have 10 slides to share with you today. And don't worry, there's only three that are charts, and I'm going to get those out of the way right here at the beginning. I feel it's important to review this because these graphs reveal an important story about the grain ethanol business that we can look at for the future. It becomes clear that grain ethanol has grown here in the U.S., and across the globe very substantially in the last 10 years. And as it grew in size, it also grew in competency and sophistication, and as a consequence, it grew in productivity. What you see in this chart is the story of grain ethanol's capital efficiency over the last 20 years. These efficiencies way exceed anything you would have expected from scale increases only. What you see in this graph is the capital charge per unit of ethanol. There are multiple curves as we go through the years, and you can see how much the capital productivity impact exceeds just the impact of scale. This happened not just by chance, but because of real inventiveness on the part of the pioneers of this industry. Better ways to run fermentations, better ways to integrate heat, better ways to manage water. Capital productivity was not the only improvement grain ethanol made throughout the decades, though. So here are some other important metrics. So let's talk just for a moment about plant performance. This on this chart is some data from the University of Illinois in Chicago and from Argonne National Labs. In the top left, what this shows is the reduction over the years in the typical consumption of energy in the form of natural gas per unit of ethanol that was produced. Directly below that is the reduction of electricity per unit of ethanol. Top right, reduction of cooling water, which of course correlates with the amount of energy that was used to make the ethanol. And lastly, in the lower right, you see the steady increase in yield, that is, in the amount of ethanol produced per unit of grain. In addition to all of this, the yield of grain that we get from the field improved. Farmers got more bushels per acre, and the combined productivity improvement in the ethanol production process plus the grain growing process made for some impressive growth in ethanol per acre. This took process improvements, equipment improvements, enzyme and yeast improvements, operating technique improvements. But it doesn't stop here, and we all know that the improvements are continuing today. Let me give you an example when it comes to enzymes. Until recently, the industry used two types of enzymes to produce ethanol from grain, an enzyme to dissolve starch and an enzyme to produce sugars from that dissolved starch. Now, increasingly, we use complex systems like the one I show on the right. There are still the two basic enzyme functions, but we've added others that make these enzymes more useful or which increase the value of the co-products we get from the plant. Additionally, in the U.S., we started to offer genetically modified yeasts that are matched to these enzyme systems for even better results. So why have we taken this trip down memory lane? To prove a simple point, the grain ethanol industry started small, and with hard work and continuous improvement, the industry is now large and highly productive. And it's going to continue to become more and more so, delivering fuel more efficiently and further concentrating grain protein into valuable animal feed and making corn oil for feed or fuel use. DuPont is proud of our contributions to the success of first-generation ethanol, and we're committed to continue to contribute to this progress in the years to come. And so this brings us to cellulosic ethanol and what DuPont sees for the future of this exciting technology as it starts to break through into commercial scale. So one of the biggest promises for our industry is the promise of biomass ethanol or cellulosic ethanol. I share the stage today with several colleagues who are part of, shall I say, an elite club of pioneers in this field, companies that have put together the complex combination of skills and assets to make this promise come true. Technically, logistically, agronomically, it's been, in many ways, a difficult journey. That's perhaps why this club is so elite. But we look forward to welcoming a host of new players to this stage and this industry as it takes off. Our journey into cellulosic biofuels began in earnest a decade ago when we started working on the development of enzymes and process technology. 5 years ago, we started a demonstration plant in Tennessee that's operated around the clock ever since. 4 years ago, we started working the fields with Iowa farmers to build what we consider to be the world's most sustainable supply chain of corn stover. And 2 years ago, we broke ground on a 30 million gallon per year cellulosic ethanol facility in Nevada, Iowa. So we're now in the final stages of construction at our facility, and we're looking forward to opening it later this year. Once we start operations, we expect to enter a new phase of learning where we're going to evolve our technology with further advances in enzyme process and supply chain technology that we can gain from our experience here. Just as we saw on first-generation ethanol, the improvement cycle will be strong in advanced ethanol. Now, many things excite me about the cellulosic ethanol market. Most of all, I'm excited by its long-term economic entitlement. That's right, entitlement. The cost of carbon is lower for cellulosic ethanol than it is for corn ethanol, and over time, it can be very competitive with oil. Now, obviously today, the conversion costs are still relatively high, But we know that these costs will decrease with experience, just as they did with grain ethanol. Combine that economic entitlement with the incomparable sustainability properties of cellulosic ethanol, and you can see why DuPont believes so strongly in this market. The promise of cellulosic ethanol as the most sustainable and the lowest cost liquid transportation fuel on the planet will be fulfilled by DuPont and by many of you in this room today. Now, last year, we made two exciting announcements. The first was a partnership with Procter & Gamble to bring cellulosic ethanol into Tide laundry detergent. For P&G, this was a bold step to be the first brand in the world to blend cellulosic ethanol in a scalable and commercial way into their detergent formulation. For DuPont, it was an important first step to diversify the markets for cellulosic ethanol beyond just fuels. Moving forward, we intend to continue to seek out new opportunities and new collaborations to transform value chains with more sustainable solutions. We believe this is an important step for the industry, and we expect there will be more of this type of diversification for cellulosic technology in the years ahead. The second announcement I want to highlight is a project in the Pelagonia region of Macedonia that we announced recently. DuPont Process Technology was selected for a project that will produce 100 million liters of the world's most sustainable cellulosic bioethanol. In essence, this is a European energy value chain for sustainable production of bioplastics, biochemicals, biofuels, and feeds. This is another important step forward in developing alternative markets for biomass technologies, like the use of ethanol for plant bottle resins. And we do it collaboratively. We have partners like Ethanol Europe, Next Step, Government of Macedonia, and the Municipality of Prilep. We're pursuing true models of public-private partnerships. Now, what we see in both of these announcements is the beginning of a bioeconomy in action. Today, the technology to unlock sugars and cellulose and the supply chains being developed to deliver those sugars at scale are enabling the commercial deployment of cellulosic ethanol. But also, DuPont and others are taking these same sugars and these same supply chains to enable a whole new world of biochemicals and biomaterials, delivering on the promise of that bio-based economy. Now, a first wave of cellulosic ethanol plants is coming into production now, and a second wave is being prepared. As we all know, last year the EPA shed enough doubt on the implementation of renewable fuel policy in the U.S. that many discussions about a second wave of cellulosic ethanol plants in the U.S. were shelved. We look forward to the EPA providing the clarity that Christopher Grundler talked about this morning. But in the meantime, we are pursuing very active discussions about second wave plants all around the world. That includes Central and Eastern Europe, like the project I just mentioned in Macedonia. It also includes Asia and South America. DuPont is involved in these regions from its other businesses around the world, and we see tremendous interest in cellulosic technology that's consistent with the chart I show here. We're beginning to see a conversion take place around the world. Grain, cane, and cellulosic ethanol are not going to remain separate. Here at home, already, our OptiMash line of advanced enzymes is used commercially by Quad County processors in northwest Iowa. They combine their new technology with DuPont's cellulosic enzymes to produce cellulosic ethanol from corn fiber, thus benefiting from more corn ethanol and more corn oil extraction in their grain ethanol plant. Continued improvement, continued delivery against the promise. Now let me turn for a moment to the issue of policy, which I know we'll be discussing on the panel. So earlier I said that the entitlement for this industry to be the lowest cost, the entitlement for the industry is to be the lowest cost and the most sustainable transportation fuel in the world, but we're not there yet. Our conversion costs are still high, and we need some time to bring those down. Therefore, as with many initiatives that benefit the common good, we call for a strong, coherent policy to grant us access to the marketplace so we might compete on the merits of our innovation without our hands tied behind our back. That's why DuPont's a strong voice in the RFS advocacy fight with leaders like Brooke and others in the Fuels America effort. We don't see this as the time to pull back those efforts. Rather, we see this as a time to push forward in the face of falling crude oil prices with voices questioning the value of renewable fuels. We don't want to fall victim to the false notion that the world no longer needs biofuels. If anything, suppressed crude oil prices ought to remind us of how that volatility keeps us vulnerable and ultimately dependent. So I leave you with this. Together, let 2015 be our surge in advanced biofuels, the year we demonstrate together that biofuels have outside benefits to a nation's policies, economic, environmental, and our energy security. DuPont looks forward to being a leading voice in this surge and to working with the pioneers of the bioeconomy as we continue to bring this vision to reality. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bill. The next panelist is Adam Monroe. Adam Monroe is the president of Novozymes North America. I think many of you are familiar with him. That's his day job. His day job is also, he's very involved in Fuels America. So he's got those two day jobs. And then he now has a night job as the new chair of the Advanced Ethanol Council. So if you want to call him, forget it. But he will talk today about Novozymes. And thank you.
Thank you, Brooke. So I'm still pondering the headline of this panel around advanced ethanol industry breaks through. Now what? I've spent so much time on Capitol Hill answering the question of when, it's odd to talk about, well, we've broken through, now what? Faced with one of my teenage daughters, I'm pretty sure the answer would have been as if, one of her favorite sayings. But here we are. Here we are with plants being built, as William just showed, and more on the panel to come. And it's a great day. It's a really special spot in this industry. For those of you who are not familiar with Novozymes, we've been providing key technology to the grain-based ethanol industry for a number of years, and we're on our third commercial version of the key enzymes needed to convert many sources of biomass into the fuels we're talking about. But one of the things that we've learned is that it is not a technology-only endeavor. It's a partnering endeavor. Whether it's working with those farmers that have to collect things like corn stover or totally new supply chains, or the supply chain truck drivers, you've got to partner across the whole chain to get there. And that's why at Novozymes we've started to understand just how important partnering and working together is. We've always believed in biological answers, but we're never going to get to where we need to go to without partnering across the spectrum. If we make this work. So Brooke asked me earlier today, you know, about the confidence in the industry, and I tell you what, we're very confident, and we've been confident. We wouldn't have put $1 billion into research and capital into this industry and 150 scientists working 24 hours a day on this for a number of years if we weren't confident. In fact, we were so confident we built this new enzyme plant in Blair, Nebraska and started it up in 2012 because we knew we needed to be way ahead of the industry. You can't get ready for the enzymes and then build a plant. They've got to be available then. And that didn't come for free. That took a lot of time and tribulation to get there. And we built that plant so that it's highly flexible, rapidly expandable. So we're very confident. But to get there, some of you remember the drought, but I wonder how many of you remember the flood. Right in the middle of 2011, while we were building this plant, had it almost up and starting it up, comes the flood. And what you see behind me is a picture of one-ton bags of sand. Those bags normally hold enzymes that we make for the detergent industry. But we sacrificed well over 1,000 to build what we called the Great Wall of Novozymes just to protect that plant from the flood. So we went through a lot just to get that plant up and running. And we wouldn't have done that if we weren't confident about where we're going to end up. But you know, at the end of the day, really what this is about is working together to live up to the dreams of the guys behind me, these 109 Zymers that we have working at that plant in Blair, and what they believe is going to happen in our industry. It's about better lives. At the end of the day, we talk a lot about fuels and cars, but at the end of the day, really, it is about better lives, whether it's cleaner fuels, cleaner air, energy independence, It's all of those things that are going to be better in the future because we bring these advanced biofuels to the table. And when I look at what those guys dream about and what they get excited about every day, and I think about what's the difference between where they know we're going to get to and what is in the way, it's this enormous canyon of the lack of knowledge about the potential of this industry in the American public, whether it's politicians or legislators or the media or your neighbor. And that's the canyon we need to fill. So we can work together to fill it. We can work together to inform policymakers, and I know we're going to talk more about policy today, but I think, honestly, it's not so much a technology question anymore, as much as we get excited about that at Novozymes, but it's more about how we work together to fill that gulf. I'll stop there. Thanks.
Thanks, Adam. Our next panelist is Paolo Carollo. I think Paolo is going to give you a little color as to what Beta Renewables does. Most of you know about the plant in Crescentino, Italy. That's Beta Renewables, and I'll let Paolo take it from here. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Brooke. And as you can see from the presentation, I'm here to substitute Guido Ghisolfi. Guido Ghisolfi is the shareholder and owner of Chemtex, BioChemtex, M&G Group. So he couldn't make it today. Winter weather and cold. So anyway, he sends his regard to everybody. Before I start, I think that everybody here knows, DuPont. Everybody knows Novozymes. Of course, Abengoa, and everybody, of course, knows Brooke, but I don't know if everybody actually heard about Beta Renewables and what we did. So just a quick introduction to explain who we are, what we are doing, and what we accomplished. So Beta Renewables is a joint venture between BioChemtex, which is an Italian engineering and technology company, between TPG, which is a U.S. large private equity fund, and between Novozymes, thanks Adams, and what Beta Renewables is and what a renewable does is basically we delivered to the market a technology platform that allows converting in an efficient way a lignocellulose biomass into biofuels and bio-based chemicals. What we accomplished is pretty much here. We were the first in the world to deliver a commercial facility producing cellulosic ethanol, cellulosic fuel ethanol. This facility is operating in Italy since about 2 years. And we are now we have now built other plants, and we are building new ones around the world. So, going to the focus of the panel today, I think the focus of the panel was, now that the technology is proven, what is the next step? And I think that our experience. And I would say the fact that we came to production with commercial volumes and commercial facilities 2 years ago really pushed us, asking us that same questions a long time ago. We are in the market of technology transfer and delivering technology solution and plans since a long time, actually since more than 60 years. And what we see for the advanced biofuels markets is not really very different from what we have seen in different regions, in different markets, in different applications, where basically technology, proving the technology, is just one of the elements which are necessary to actually boost the potential of an industry to take off. What are the other elements? Of course, what Will was mentioning before, efficiency, gain of yields, delivering facility that will cost less and less going further. That is typical of any technology that we have seen and that we have been improving over the course of the years. But also market. And market in our case is availability of viable feedstock and availability of demand for the liquid fuels, which is not, you know, a given. Third is policy. If you want something that puts together all these elements, is the, in the end, the availability of sources for financing, which also has been, has proven to be a quite tough issue to address. So let me go through this point, but before we go through this point, it might be actually worthy to give you just an overview of where we are in the technology deployment. You know, I mentioned the plant in Crescentino in Italy. It's a 14 million gallon facility. It's working on straw, actually straw and other energy grasses, but mostly straw. It's operating and operating well since at least a year and a half right now. And besides this facility, another facility, a 22 million gallon facility, came up in Brazil, started up with Gran Bio a few months ago, and is using sugarcane bagasse and leaves and straw from sugarcane. Another facility is now being constructed, you know, with our technology platform in Slovakia by Energochemica. It's a large chemical company that will have this facility operating by 2016, the end of 2016. That facility will be producing, I think, 19 million gallons of ethanol, and it's going to be using straw as a feedstock. Besides these facilities, there are several other plants that are right now under, you know, planning, and I would say an advanced stage of development. I would say probably one of the closest one is one facility here in the United States that will be using energy grasses. Three biorefineries in Italy, and a 60 million gallon biorefinery, the largest so far, that will be using straw in China. And several others, you know, projects that are being developed that are coming to fruition in other parts of the world. But the point being, we are proving technology in different parts of the world on different feedstock. The risk is not only technology, but also commercial risk. Now, is that enough? No, it's not. Going back to the three elements that I was mentioning before, you know, markets. So, you know, if it is quite, I would say, clear to everybody that there are several regions in the world where it's possible to find viable sources of feedstock, and by viable I mean non-competing with foods and at economically viable cost, it is quite heavy the impact that right now the industry is getting from price of oil at $40 per barrel. Now, you know, there is a lot of confusion clearly in the international market community for this, but you know, the fundamentals are pretty strong here. The long-term availability of fossil fuels is limited. So if you are in for the long run, as we are, as DuPont is, and as Abengoa is, as all the other technology providers are, we will see certainly market trends, you know, going up and down, market with oil at 100, 120, and maybe back to 40. But one thing is clear, is that the main fundamental added value proposition that, let's say, advanced biofuels, cellulosic biofuels are bringing, is to be able to complement, to make more sustainable a mix of fuels that cannot be only based on fossil sources. We understood this well. Our group decided to actually that's the support, the effort of developing this technology as a way to source alternative raw materials for its main business, which is chemical business. And we believe that that is true not only for the chemical side, but also for the fossil fuel side. So going back to the other elements that I mentioned before, policy. Well, policy, honestly, we didn't see a lot happening in the U.S. lately. I can say that two main issues. One, 2022 is just around the corner, and the investors are actually starting to perceive 2022 as pretty much of a deadline for what else after. We need to come up, the policy needs to be somehow extended or confirmed in a way in which investors will be comfortable with whatever is beyond 2022. Clearly a huge potential for improvement, I would say, in terms of certainty of having a policy and effectiveness in the way in which the policy works. Anyway, you know, we see, honestly, a lot going on in other parts of the world. As I mentioned, we are developing projects internationally, and, Bob Dineen this morning was talking about, I believe, 68 countries where there is some sort of renewable policy in place. Well, specifically for cellulosic right now, I can make some examples, but, for example, in Italy, it just came in into effect a mandate that by 2018 will actually obligated party to use a mix of cellulosic fuel. If they don't do so, they could be exposed to hefty fines. Certainly, I would say, substantial enough to make sure that that mandate will be seriously considered. Finland is coming along, and some other countries in Europe are coming along too. But not to mention Brazil, not to mention China, where policy are not that strong, but the financial support and the economic support to the establishment of this facility were so substantial that triggered investments massively. I would say that for us, it's quite interesting to see that while our pipeline is growing and healthy, very healthy overseas, here in the U.S., it's kind of hard to get traction. And, interestingly enough, the few things that are actually emerging here are with the support of foreign investors. So, without going too much into detail of the policy, but we need to realize that in the end, without a way to materialize interest from investors and open the door to the third element that I mentioned before, which is financing opportunities, access to the financial markets, this industry will take more time to deploy. And the fact that certain countries are helping more is quite significant for us. I would say that with the maturity and the skills, the structure that financial market in U.S. Represents, there is certainly potential for finding opportunities, for finding ways to make the deployment of the cellulosic industry faster, more effective, and I would say even safer. I mean, we will need to spend time to get the investment community, the financing community, familiar with the specific risk and the specific the peculiarity, I would say, of this project, of this industry. But without that, it's going to be, I would say, a shame for U.S. to not to materialize or to not to build and achieve on the position of leader of the renewable space that the U.S. had for so many years. I'm glad to be able to share these concepts with you guys today, and I think this will be probably part of our discussion later. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Paolo. Our next panelist is Chris Stanley. I don't think he needs an introduction. Former chair of the RFA, founding member of the AEC. Chris, thanks for joining.
Thanks, Brooke, and thanks to everyone. It is certainly an honor to be here today and to be a part of this esteemed panel of friendly competitors. I think that it is interesting that, of course, each of us is pushing and driving for the success of our own company, but I think almost uniquely each of us also recognizes the importance of the success of this industry as a whole. And I think that we have a unique perspective of trying to work together to make sure that this industry is successful and that we continue to see additional commercialization and further growth. To answer the question, I'm kind of like Adam, the question, what's next? It's like, wow, we just got here. But, you know, frankly, Abengoa has been thinking for the last 10 years what's next. And we think, you know, obviously we all have long-term business plans. So I think in order to really evaluate that question, and let me figure out how to advance this. There we go. No. To evaluate that question fairly, you have to kind of look back and see how you got here, what you had to overcome, and what some of the problems are. So, you know, a brief, you know, summary of Abengoa. Abengoa is an international company, a technology company that develops technologies in sustainable areas in energy and environment regions. So we have huge investments in biofuels, huge investments in solar production, solar electricity production. We do desalination of drinking water. We do water treatment. We do we build environmentally friendly infrastructures and promote new development of new technologies to promote all of these. From an ethanol or biofuel standpoint, we've certainly established a large first-generation ethanol presence around the world. We have six first-generation facilities operating in the United States, six in Europe, two in Brazil, and with a total of about 840 million gallons of annual production. Additionally, we produce byproducts such as sugar, cattle feed, electricity, and we even have some biodiesel production. So that's been going on, and Abengoa has been in that business for about 20 years or a little bit longer. But what that has led to on our side is a vision that the future expansion of this industry is going to be largely in second-generation technologies. We don't think the first generation is going anywhere. We still have many of these assets that we think are very long-term key assets for fuel production around the world on all three continents where we have a presence. But second generation, we think, is a key to the future. So in that light, we have spent the last 10 years developing second-generation technologies, first working with DOE as early as 2003, ultimately building a pilot plant and producing cellulosic ethanol in York, Nebraska in 2007, then building a demonstration-scale plant in central Spain, producing cellulosic ethanol there for thousands and thousands of hours in 2009, and recently opening one of the very first and one of the very few second-generation commercial-scale cellulosic ethanol assets in the world. We held a grand opening in October of last year and are very pleased to be finally done with construction and completing the startup phase of that facility. We've done that through a combination of focusing on technology, on patents, on ideals, and we have also recently, over the last 18 months, tried to start to think of the future and think of diversifying feedstocks, diversifying products. One of the first things we have done for the last 18 months, we have been operating our demonstration scale facility in central Spain on municipal solid waste, trash, the organic portion of landfill waste that can be used to extract cellulosic sugars, turn those cellulosic sugars into fuels, ethanol, or other similar products. So jumping back to our Hugoton, Kansas facility just briefly, we're thrilled to be in this position to finally be done with construction. We've got proprietary enzymes that we've developed that have been produced on a commercial scale as expected. We are continuing the process at Hugoton of the ramp up, and the annual capacity of this facility is about 25 million gallons with using between 300,000 and 350,000 tons of biomass per year to generate not only the 25 million gallons of ethanol, but also 21 megawatts of renewable electricity. So the facility provides all of its own power, all of its own steam, all of its own electricity, and actually has between 4 and 8 megawatts of electricity left over to sell back to the grid. Always have to bring a couple of pictures of the facility, even now that it's done. Everything here from, you know, the obligatory night picture in the lower right-hand corner to the photograph of a semi-tractor trailer unloading its load of biomass onto one of the four conveyors that allow us to unload that four trucks simultaneously of biomass into the conveyor and directly into the system. Just to talk about a little bit about what Abengoa values and how we got to where we are, we believe that we have a pioneering spirit, that we have a history of expertise in the entire value chain, everything from the proprietary enzymes that we've developed to extensive experience in feedstock procurement and logistics to process technology, to a robust marketing, trading, and risk management group, to the history as an international contractor for over 70 years. We've got over 86 patents issued in the bioenergy area. We have over $700 million invested in 2G product portfolios, including Hugoton and other facilities. The federal loan guarantee that has kind of been used to validate our technology, over 27,000 operations at a pilot plant and 6,000 operations in commercial scale demo. So what has been the progress to date, and where do we go from here? I think it's important to take a look at the tremendous progress that we've made over the last 4 or 5 years. From 2010 through today, we've been able to dramatically reduce enzyme costs, and this is not just specifically Abengoa, but it's also the industry as a whole. These are, you know, Abengoa's, you know, internal numbers as to where we think we are today. But and we've been able to reduce enzyme costs from $1.85 a gallon to closer to 50 cents per gallon. We think there's room to improve that further to make that even more competitive, get down to potentially 30 cents per gallon over the next few years. Our yeast costs have gone down roughly 20% from 2010 through where we expect to be in a few years. And our yield of gallons per ton of biomass have dramatically improved from 55 gallons per ton 4 or 5 years ago to 75 gallons per ton today. And again, we think there's room for improvement. Looking to the future from Abengoa's standpoint, we believe this is just kind of an outline of where Abengoa is going. It shows the fact that we have completed construction of Hugoton. That's 100%, the construction and the technology is 100% done. We have announced recently our next project, which is a second-generation cellulosic ethanol plant to be built in Brazil, co-located with one of our existing sugar facilities there. We have the sugarcane assets, so we will produce not only sugarcane and ethanol, but we will now take some of the excess parts of the cane plant that are left in the field after harvest, after mechanical harvest now, and utilize those that cellulosic material to produce second-generation ethanol. We have recently announced a preliminary agreement with BNDES to finance that project for us. We have also been working the third leg of the stool, so to speak, or the third phase of this project is the waste to biofuel that I mentioned before we've been doing for 18 months in Salamanca, Spain. We are working now with municipalities, major urban areas around the world, to try and come up with the best spot for our first waste to biofuels facility in either the U.S. or Europe or Asia or someplace else. We're also looking at other particular chemicals. We have an N-butanol project that's a ways down the product line. Bottom line is we're looking to diversify both our feedstocks and our products to create a more robust industry and company. Of course, we have the first-generation feedstocks, corn, wheat, sorghum, sugarcane, also second-generation feedstocks of stover, whether that be corn stover, wheat straw, sugarcane residues, and even municipal solid waste. We have our enzymes as a product. We utilize those enzymes in extracting the cellulosic sugars from the cellulosic biomass, and then now we are looking to convert those sugars not just like the corn starch that we convert to first-generation ethanol, but now converting the agricultural residues and soon municipal solid waste to cellulosic ethanol, not to mention other products such as chemicals, acids, plastics, resins, and other products that that are out there and available. So with that said, I know most people are interested in getting to the Q&A session, and so I think we'll turn it back over to Brooke and move right into that.
Thank you, Chris. So we will do that. If you have a question, come up to the mic. Until I see somebody, I'll ask my own questions. So I guess I'm going to start with the, seeing no questions yet, the bridge between 1G and 2G technology. We got a lot of 1G people in this room. We got a lot of 2G people emerging. And one of the things that's happened on Capitol Hill, being a government relations person, is people are starting to see that, and members of Congress are starting to see that. So if you don't mind, talk a little bit more about what the bridge between 1G and 2G technologies from your company perspective, if you'd like. Bill, do you want to start? Adam, do you want to start?
Okay. Thanks, Brooke. So as many of you know, we have had a long history in participation in our enzyme business with our acquisition of Genencor a few years ago. In 1G, and we've learned a lot from that. As I said in my talk, we have seen a tremendous improvement in productivity that happened in 1G. It was not the case at the time when 1G started that everybody in the industry believed, or everybody in Capitol Hill and the industry in the world believed that could happen. And we've drawn a lot of analogies and expectations from that as we go into our 2G. The other thing is, I believe, is we're going to see a mixture of 1G and 2G facilities and companies as we go forward. Biomass tends to come places where there's also starch collection, and the companies that know how to do 1G are also going to be very very knowledgeable in running the 2G plants. So I think as we go forward, we're going to see more and more of a mixture of the two technologies and the two industries, which I think will be good for everybody. Thanks.
Yeah. So, sorry. In addition to what Bill said, I think one of the things we recognize working in the 1G industry is that it's not just a fuel industry. It's many different products. It's biorefining. And whether we can now start to work on corn fiber to cellulosic ethanol, or we work with different waste streams, a lot of things have happened that connect the two. But the biggest one, if you ask me, is it's the most obvious place to put the most productive agricultural machinery, people in the world together to learn how to collect these and build these new feedstock supply chains on readily available crop residues. And those things connect certainly with the economy of scale of collecting them at the same facilities, using lignin to fire both plants, et cetera. So I think the examples are numerous. But I think the one that also binds the two together that I think is lost on Washington sometimes is that you can't pass a law and say we'd like 15 billion gallons of fuel by 2015 and have an entire dedicated group of people across the country run out, build those plants, actually get ahead of the curve, and then tell them when you get there, well, we're not sure we wanted that much right now. The signal that that sends to investors in the 2G industry are enormous. So now what? Now we have a political fight between those two for market share? How does this work? So my answer to that is always that they're very synergistic technology-wise, and everybody's watching how you're treating both 1G and 2G together from an investment perspective.
Well, so no, I fully believe that there is a lot of
opportunity for the corn industry in building further additional capacity through cellulosic platforms. I think that it's probably under the eyes of everybody that the European Union, but, you know, internationally, is going to be tougher and tougher to expand further capacity using corn feedstock. Right or wrong, that's a fact of life, okay? There is probably a risk mitigation that is intrinsically bound into the cellulosic platforms, which is not only policy risk mitigation, but is also economic risk mitigation. These crops that are used for the lignocellulosic crops and feedstock that are used for the cellulosic industry do not have commodity price trends, are relatively flat in terms of pricing, especially if we are talking about energy grasses. So there are complementary elements in with which the cellulosic industry can complement, can add additional volume, can subtract risk, and you know, to the corn industry and the corn business. We think that, for example, here in the States, the main area of production is the Corn Belt. Well, using different feedstock, using energy crops, well, you can start producing in areas where producing corn is uneconomical. You know, it's under the eyes of everybody that, you know, the few cellulosic facilities that are being built here in the States are somehow piggybacking on supply chains that are already built around corn. So there is complementary synergy, and we don't see this as a competition, provided that the policy allows the volumes to expand in the future.
I certainly agree that there's an indisputable connection between first and second generation technologies. Just to expand a little bit on what Adam said, which I fully agree with, you just cannot, as either a regulator or a legislator, go out and pull the plug on a program, a promise, in essence, that has been made to the industry and to the investors in that industry halfway through the life cycle of the program. That's just going to kill future investment altogether. So we all are certainly working and hoping that we can convince both the legislature and the EPA to stay the course on the renewable fuel standard. That being said, the reason that there is such a connection, in my opinion, is largely the fact that, you know, the first generation industry has done a tremendous amount of expansion, a tremendous job in building up to virtually 10% of the United States transportation fuel supply. In addition to that, that same first generation capacity is the most likely customer for implementation of second generation type projects, both from the standpoint not just the potential adding on of a second generation addition or front end to an existing facility where you have all of these synergies that potentially can make that addition much more economical than it might be in a greenfield type site. But in addition to that, the two or three companies out there today and more to come, I am sure, in the future that are now working on kind of a 1.5 generation concept, and you've heard some of those folks at this conference, the idea that there are additional portions of the grain besides the starch which can be used to expand the production of an existing starch plant. So, you know, indisputable connection. We just have to keep moving on.
I'm going to ask you to expand on one thing, Chris, and then we'll run it back the other way. The feedstock question. Obviously, we don't have a monochromatic landscape in terms of feedstocks. How do you see that? Is that a problem or a challenge for the next wave of plants, or how do you see the feedstock equation rolling out? I mean, is it going to be just on piggybacking on the grain ethanol industry, or how do you see that rolling out?
And I'm having trouble hearing you, but you said monochromatic feedstock in first generation?
We have some feedback, but we do not have a monochromatic feedstock landscape out there, and so it's going to be a patchwork quilt and different challenges in different places. So how do you see that rolling out without getting into the crystal ball stuff, which is...
Yeah, no doubt. I think I see that as an advantage. There are obviously challenged to overcome in every area. But as I mentioned, I think diversification, both on the feedstock side coming in and on the product side going out, gives a company the best chance of long-term success and options to consider multiple types of you know business interests. But you know, for example, as I mentioned, we on the first generation side, we have plants here in the U.S. that have traditionally used corn. We have plants that have traditionally used grain sorghum. We have plants in Brazil that use sugar cane. We have plants in Europe that use barley and wheat. So, you know, on the first generation side, it's more diverse than people might think. On the second generation side, there's a tremendous amount of biomass available. Everything from forest residues to you know ag residues to municipal solid waste to multiple other types. So we see that as a big advantage, frankly, and a market and an opportunity to take advantage of.
I probably already mentioned before how many feedstock and how many areas we are actually already deploying technology. So it's a technical issue, right? Some platforms are, let's say, more prone to be flexible, other less prone. We are blessed. We have a decently flexible technology. I think that one interesting concept that we are starting to use is putting together a supply chain where actually there is not a unique component in the feedstock, but there is a mix of three, four sometimes components. This helps actually reducing the cost and reducing the risk. We try to maximize the concept of basically fresh chopped material being delivered to the biorefinery and being processed in a very short time. We are trying to avoid with that baling cost, reprocessing cost, storage cost. So it's an opportunity. There is a lot of creativity out there, and there are different ways in which you really can deploy this. I actually think that it's a great opportunity for the industry to come up with something that is innovative and more innovative, let's say, than what has been seen so far.
Yeah, and I'll just take a completely different twist on this. I think the diversity of the feedstocks is a real opportunity for our industry because it's geographically diverse, which means a lot of different parts of the world and society can participate in this. You know, if you talk to mayors about sending their trash not to the landfill but to a plant that we could build nearby, they get really excited. You talk about growing an energy crop and collecting that where we, you know, may currently just spray some kind of livestock waste on low-margin land in a very rural, poor part of the United States. Those guys get really excited. I had a congresswoman who will remain nameless who asked me, you know, could we convert all those leaves that collect in her neighborhood in the fall into something good? And I said, yes, of course we could. But I think the opportunity for society to participate in this, if we can sort through the supply chain, and that is not an easy thing, and it's going to take a lot of working together. But if you get people who see job opportunity and technology innovation in their backyard based upon a unique feedstock they have, I think that's one of the neatest things about this industry and something it really can offer society.
So I'll take a little bit different tact. So from a technological perspective, we can tweak the technology, both the enzyme and the process, to work on a lot of different biomass sources. But as I said in my talk, the key to this industry is in improving productivity and getting our costs down as quickly as possible. And the best way for that to happen is the same way as what happened in the grain ethanol industry. We work on we find a similar feedstock. We build a number of plants that effectively learn from each other, and we get down that experience curve as fast as possible. So I know there's a lot of opportunity for alternative feedstocks. I think practically speaking, the best opportunity for the industry to get started is in corn stover and possibly in sugarcane in Brazil, because those are the places where we can put in a large number of plants and really take advantage of the learnings that we're all going to get over the next number of years by operating these plants.
Question in the front.
Okay. My name is Rob Vierhout. I have a question to maybe the entire panel. In any case, to Mr. Carollo, you said that you built the first commercial plant. Credit to you. Can you tell us if your plant is commercial? Does it? Is it? And maybe to widen the question a bit, what is the business model? What makes it economically viable? Is it the feedstock? Is it the fact that you need to have a credit for the electricity you produce? Is it the price you get for your ethanol?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So basically, you have a different answer in different regions, okay? The facility that you have seen is a 14 million gallon facility which is operating. The facility which has been built in Brazil is a 22 million gallon facility which is operating, and they are operating at commercial scale, commercial volumes being produced. Very different situation. The reason why we located our first facility, which was more of a demonstration commercial in Italy, was because our center of technology and R&D centers and engineering centers were located there. We wanted to have access to our R&D facilities and our technology capabilities 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The startup of that first of a kind was not easy, a lot of learnings. We wanted to have that facility close to where we had our core of expertise. Now, this is probably one of the toughest places in the world to actually get decent pricing on feedstock, and where there is no, or there was not, policy available for liquid fuels. So not easy, right? Last year, we had several occasions to consider if to produce or not to produce. But the intent of that project was really to prove technology. That plant was built with a number of flexibility around it, which could accommodate a different setup, different configurations, different feedstock, different solutions. It was a demonstration commercial facility. We wanted to make sure that we had the means to allow our investors, the guys that would be licensing technology from us, to try their feedstock, to have validations, to try new setup. And that is the way in which delivered it. Very expensive plant compared to what we could do in a second of a kind. Because it has everything around it. Energy was a great way to support that investment. Feed-in rates in Europe are very interesting. So yes, that is part of the equation that makes that plant profitable even in a challenging environment. Now, you look at the situation in Brazil, you look at the situation in Slovakia, you look at what we are doing in China, in Italy, in U.S., they are all different situations. Here in U.S., there are no feed-in rates. We don't even have conversion to electricity. We feel like for us it's, actually diluting the profitability of the project later on. So we are having another approach here. Same thing for Brazil, where instead electricity has an interesting price and there is a component. So it's hard to respond to your question, but yes, these are commercial facilities producing commercial volumes, being relatively economic for the environment in which they have been built. Now, the more your feedstock is competitive, the more the policy is supportive, the more the profitability of your plant will be repaid fast. Okay? Is that it?
Any other questions? All right, I'll ask the oil price question, because everybody asked me that question. How has the change in oil price affected your outlook, not just for the industry, but change your behavior at your company and change your thinking, if at all? Does anybody want to attack that one? I'm sure you've never been asked.
You're right. Can you hear me?
Yep.
So we don't want to be predicting oil pricing. It's moved from $100 to $50 over a fairly short period of time, and I'm sure it will move back as we go forward. So I guess a couple of points. One is the volatility over, just say, the last 12 months should really remind us and remind the policymakers how important it is to have alternative sources besides just hydrocarbons for our fuel and ultimately for chemicals and biomaterials. As far as how it affects our thinking, we're still very positive on this market. And the reason we are is because when we look around the world, we see good reasons for cellulosic energy to continue. So we believe that, in fact, the RFS will get sorted out in the U.S. and we will start moving forward. If we look at Europe, we know that Europe is inclined to take steps to reduce its dependency on foreign oil imports, and cellulosic energy is a good way to do that. If we look at countries like Brazil and Macedonia, we know that they want rural development. Cellulosic, second-generation cellulosic plants are excellent ways to do that because they drive not just the plant labor, but also all that agricultural labor to collect the biomass. And lastly, we know that California is absolutely committed and is putting real resources on carbon reduction. So those are all good reasons why cellulosic ethanol is going to continue even in the face of the oil price volatility we've seen, and why we're still saying full speed ahead. Thanks.
Anybody else?
Well, I'd just like to add that, you know, we live in a commodity market. I mean, our world is a commodity market. We've had high margins and low margins. We've had high oil prices and low oil prices. And one of my favorite adages is from the corn industry, and that says, you know, the cure for high prices is high prices. Certainly, it's our belief that oil prices will not remain in the $50 per barrel range for very long. And despite the fact that they are currently at $50 per barrel, you know, we still... And despite the fact that the United States is producing more oil than it ever has before, we still import roughly a third of our transportation fuel needs from other countries. And that's just not a good scenario. In my mind, today's price scenario is just the perfect example of why we need alternatives. And it's because we are not in control of our fate. As easily as the oil prices came down, they can go back up.
Anybody else want to talk about oil prices? All right. Last question, briefly. We've touched on it, but I want to hear a little bit more on it. Global competitiveness. Our industry is being pulled in a bunch of different directions. Oil prices, questions about the RFS, incentives in China. Has that changed over the last year, year and a half? Why has it changed? And what are the things that are pulling us overseas? And is it organic and we're just thinking about this industry globally, or is the United States losing the competition? That's a free-for-all. Anybody can
Yeah, I can take part of that anyway. I think one thing that's obvious about that answer is that the technology and all the things that you've seen on slides today is starting to become more public, more available. The word is spreading. We're out there. And some of the benefits of biomass, renewable carbon sources is to society, it's got a lot of governments interested, and for different strategic reasons, as well as, you know, really good, cheap, available sources of biomass around the world, whether you find them in Southeast Asia or Brazil, where marketplace for the end product is a given. And so I guess what I'm getting at is that as the understanding of technology and the capability to do it grows, all the folks out there that have feedstock and strategic reasons to get into the business are knocking on the door and pushing pretty hard. And there's a investment community that's following that same trail, which is why it's not surprising that, as Bill mentioned, you see what's happening in Brazil, for that matter, Asia, China, other places.
To me, it's just surprising.